On this week's 51%, we spend the show with gender and religion scholar Laura Levitt. You'll hear her story of rape, and while not graphic, please be forewarned. She hopes more federal attention is paid to unprocessed rape kits.
The idea that an actress who plays the part of an officer in a special victims unit is the national spokesperson for trying to get rape kits processed in the United States seems like, you know, an obscene reality.
I'm Allison Dunn, and this is 51%.
Is that why they call me a sullen girl? Sullen girl. They don't know I used to sail the deep and tranquil sea.
On a November evening in 1989, Laura Levitt was raped in her own bed. Her landlord heard the assault taking place and called 911, but the police arrived too late to apprehend Levitt's attacker. When they left, investigators took items with them, a pair of sweatpants and more, and a rape exam was performed at the hospital. However, this evidence was never processed. Decades later, Levitt returns to these objects, viewing them not as clues that will lead to the identification of her assailant, but rather as a means of engaging traumatic legacies writ large. Her latest book, The Objects That Remain, is equal parts personal memoir and an examination of the ways in which the material remains of violent crimes inform our experiences of and thinking about trauma and loss. And considering artifacts in the United States Holocaust Memorial Museum and evidence in police storage facilities across the country, Levitt's story moves between intimate trauma, the story of an unsolved rape, and genocide. Throughout, she asks what it might mean to do justice to these violent pasts outside the juridical system or through historical empiricism, which are the dominant ways in which we think about evidence from violent crimes and other highly traumatic events. Levitt is professor of religion, Jewish studies, and gender at Temple University. You know, I have to tell you that the second I started reading, about your book and more, I was struck with this image from Steven Spielberg's movie Schindler's List, where I believe it's at the beginning of the movie, it was so long ago, that he used, you know, like sneakers that had been left behind and just objects. And it was such a visceral image. And I don't know why reading about your book brought to mind that image to me, but it did. Just what that all means. So let's get more into your memoir and your story. And, you know, what prompted you to write this book?
Really began as I was completing the last book that I wrote, which was called American Jewish Loss After the Holocaust. And I was thinking about how different losses touch. And I was fortunate to meet the poet Maggie Nelson. And she had just written a book of poems about her aunt who had been murdered before she was born. And she had written a book of poetry about her aunt's life and death called Jane, a Murder. And as that book went to print, it turned out there was a break in this 30-some-odd-year-old cold case. And when I met Maggie Nelson, she had just gone to the preliminary hearing in what became her aunt's murder trial. And we have mutual friends, and we were having dinner, and she was describing being in that courtroom. And she talked about, you know, finding, she didn't know that there was all of this stuff that had been taken the night that her aunt was murdered, including the clothing that her aunt wore the night that she was murdered. And hearing about that clothing really astonished me, because I actually care about clothing, and it occurred to me that I had not thought about what was taken from my apartment the night that I was raped in 1989. And so I became interested in thinking about what happens to those kinds of objects that are taken. And because I was working on Holocaust memory, at that time I was working more with photographs, but I started thinking about the troves of material evidence that are a part of places like the United States Holocaust Memorial Museum. And I became curious about how these things were related and, of course, how they related to my story. And like you, I'm also very taken by images of clothing. And it's not surprising to me, again, that you return to Spielberg and think about how those material objects figure in the film. I was thinking also about the little girl who was wearing the red coat. And that red coat became kind of a figure throughout the film as a way of trying to help audiences remember the individuality of all of the people who were harmed and who died and who were, you know, treated so horrifically. But that's one of the challenges when we talk about Holocaust memory.
You know, separately, when you look at, horrible natural disasters and you see burnt clothing or clothing full of mud, depending on the type of disaster, you know, it's just so striking, those images. So I wanted to talk about your affinity for clothing and shoes. What is this about?
Well, I like to think that my mother was a little girl who grew up in the 30s and 40s and liked playing with paper dolls. And she was a school teacher who I was born in 1960, and in the early 60s, it seemed that she had to leave teaching in order to stay home with her young children. And I think my mother, dare I say this, was a bit bored being at home. And I think part of what ended up happening is I was the first child and she liked playing dress-ups with me. And I suspect that that's kind of where some of this began. And so I begin the book by talking about my own kind of affection for clothing. And I would personify my clothing. I'd talk to shoes. I would talk to, you know, other pieces of clothing. I feel bad when, you know, they'd be replaced by new ones and things like that. And so I kind of wanted to begin there because I wanted to kind of remember that it's not just in traumatic moments that we care about objects, but that most of us care about objects in our lives in different ways, obviously. But the idea to be reminded of having forgotten about my clothing from this most traumatic moment of my life was really startling given this other proclivity.
So then let's go back to that. So then you explained at the beginning what prompted you to return, you know, 30 years ago. I know you did file a formal request for information. What was it you were expecting to find?
Well, to be honest with you, it took me a long time to file that request for information. I had very little confidence in the Atlanta police. That's where I had been raped, and nothing ever happened in my case. So I went into this with very low expectations. And in fact, I think I had imagined that I would have a final chapter that basically was nothing remains. But instead, in 2014, after I had been working on the book for some time, I did make that formal request, and I was pleasantly surprised. First of all, they didn't get back to me, but eventually I let it sit for about 2 months, and then I called the Atlanta police. I made a cold call, and after, you know, sending me from one person to the next, I finally got to this wonderful sergeant, I believe, in sex crimes. And she said to me, "Oh, funny you should call. I have your case file on my desk. My partner and I have been looking for your evidence." This was really a surprise for me. And we had a very long conversation, and this wonderful sergeant answered so many of my questions about the statute of limitations, whether or not the Atlanta police had retested DNA evidence from cases going back to the 80s, and indeed they had. So I learned many, many things on that phone call. But in the end, they were never able to find any of my evidence. But when I got off the phone, I realized that she had my case file. And so I immediately emailed back and said, "Would it be possible for you to share a copy of the case file with me?" And so I had that case file, and that was not nothing. That was something. And I write about some of that in the book, and I, you know, and part of it was the sort of shock of what was in that report that took me a while to process. So I had not remembered, for example, that when the police were in my apartment that night, that they took photographs of me, of my bruised arms, of my bruised neck and my face, and I was kind of shocked by seeing those pictures. I also found in the file, a few days later, I had gone to the police to give my formal statement, and at the time, they were not computerized, so there was someone typing what I was saying. And then they gave me the typed manuscript and had me edit it. So it looks like, you know, in the old days, well, a year ago when I used to write on student papers, it looked like a student paper, and it was my handwriting. And so those were all quite surprising and shocking and meaningful, but disturbing.
How has that impacted you? How did it, I don't know, in the story writing, I'm just, how is this impacting you now?
Well, you know, I think we live with trauma, those of us who have experienced violence, and it's an ongoing process, right? I talk about this as kind of the afterlives, and we live different afterlives, and we come back to key moments in our lives differently, and sort of the way in which I'm a religious studies scholar. So, you know, I think about how people read sacred texts, and you read the same text over and over again, and you come back to them, but you come back to them with different eyes because you're in a different place in your life. And so I think being able to return to my experience through an extended engagement with the objects that were taken that night, and to think about my story with those objects who were there with me then, I think that was a really different way of kind of being able to engage. And part of why I felt so powerfully about doing it this time is that reading the words of not only Maggie Nelson, but I also write about Edmund Duval, who wrote a fantastic family memoir about his family and all that they lost in the Holocaust called The Hare with Amber Eyes. And seeing these other writers write beautifully and powerfully about their family stories with intimacy and erudition and thoughtfulness, but really focusing on objects. I knew that what they had done for me was they allowed me to feel like I wasn't so alone, that the objects occasioned a kind of companionship for me. And my hope was that in writing this book, and thus far I feel very humbled and moved that many people who have already read the book or are beginning to read the book have been able to kind of make that kind of connection. So it's companionship that I think is really powerful, and objects open up that space because, we all have ordinary clothing that we wear, and when we see clothing, as you talked about, in those disaster moments, we're reminded of how ordinary life gets radically changed in such moments, right? And the objects somehow powerfully hold that sort of tension and terror and also familiarity.
So, Laura, if we cross the bridge into the Holocaust Museum, and you say Holocaust artifacts will not ever be used as material evidence, right, in a court of law, they do, however, serve justice. How is this?
Well, part of the ways in which I think that they do justice is that in a place like the museum in Washington, which has a very strong collection of material objects, they are there so that scholars and writers and poets and musicians and other artists can go and use those archives and breathe new life into those stories. And so I think that we do justice by telling stories, by keeping these memories alive and powerful. And of course, it's not like, the key historian is going to go and tell the one story and that's it and it's over. Rather, stories breathe life into these objects. And so they stay alive and breathing because they're not pinned down to one single story. But it's all of these different takes that people bring their own gifts to those stories. And that's part of what I think is so powerful about the way in which these kinds of Holocaust evidence, these pieces of evidence, can work to do justice to that past. They do it through the writing, as I say, of historians or the work of an artist or a journalist or a painter.
There was something, this is kind of going back to the case itself, your case, and there was something that really struck me. And you talk about, police who oversee property rooms, generally, they're learning on the job, right? You're not professionally trained to oversee a property room. Why do you think this is a significant oversight?
That's a great question, Allison. I spent a lot of time trying to understand what the police do, and I was fortunate enough to discover this international association, which is trying to professionalize these practices, and I got to take a course with them. And my argument is that we think in the law, we think about custody as kind of only within the context of the chain of custody or provenance. So where did they get it, et cetera, et cetera. And then it's sort of, it's in its end point, it goes into police property management, right? That's custody, and custody is the end point. And part of what I want to argue is that actually custody is a lot of work, in the same way it is if you're caring for, you're in the custody of a child or a relative who has special needs or an elderly parent. You have to care for them, right? You have to make sure that they have all of the things that they need. And in the case of objects, it means that you need to be able to know where the object is. You need to make sure that whatever is salient about it will not be somehow compromised while in custody. So the temperature has to be right. The kind of container which holds the object also has to be appropriate, so that if you need to come back to test DNA, that there will indeed be DNA evidence. And so part of what I argue is that because most of this labor is invisible, and even as, again, when we talk about the law, it just kind of assumes that once it's in custody, it's all taken care of. And part of what I hope to shed light on is the ongoing labor of custody. And I think in shedding light on that, we can begin to understand why it is that all of those rape kits sitting in all kinds of storage facilities across the United States have not been processed. Because the law, and because of the way in which we think about this more broadly, we don't think about what's going on behind the scenes. And I think to shed more light on this shows how that labor is crucial to the legal system. Because without custody, without people attending to those objects, there would be no evidence were your case to ever go to court, as it did in the case that Maggie Nelson wrote about.
I'm hoping, and I recognize I'm going to be asking a very broad question, but I'm hoping you can bring gender into this and how that might affect either relationships with objects, how we care for objects, you know, that are important, that have meaning. I'm hoping to bring gender into this conversation.
And this is a great question. And I think, first of all, when I talk about invisible labor, there is a way, even when it's not necessarily done by exclusively done by women, that invisible labor, the labors of care, are often both completely necessary and at the same time figured as extraneous or not important. And so when I think about the arts and the rights of custody or property management in or collections management or conservation at a place like the Holocaust Museum, I'm talking about cyclical labor, labor that has to be done on a regular daily basis. A lot of that is, custodial labor, right? And I think a lot of that is often often feminized labor and disparaged as such. The second thing I want to talk about is, I was raped, and the intimacy of that kind of violation, a violation of my body, does connect powerfully as well to the intimacy of clothing and the kinds of ways in which culturally so many of us are gendered through clothing, right? We are kind of taught how to perform certain kinds of genders in the ways in which we dress and comport ourselves. And clothing becomes a key piece in some of those enactments, for better and for worse. And as someone who was raised, I'm now 60 years old, in a time where those gender boundaries were much more rigid than they are now, I think that that has a lot to do with my own engagement with clothing. I think that that's a part of it, and I think it is, alas, quite gendered.
What is your message for victims of violence?
I understand how lonely it is to have experienced violation. And because I found companionship in the writing of these beautiful writers, Maggie Nelson and Edmund Duval in particular, I really wanted to be able to write a book that could speak to others who have been harmed. And I knew that objects were a way of doing that. And so what I hope is I want the book to be a kind of companionship. Not everyone can tell their stories. I want to really be incredibly careful and respectful that only those who have experienced violation can figure out what feels right to them. And so I don't want anyone who has suffered to feel like there's an obligation that they should do what I did, because I think that this worked for me. And I think that those who have had these experiences know best what works right, what works best for them. And I think for me to be able to tell my story was a way of, again, offering some companionship to others who've suffered.
I did want to have you talk about faith, because certainly that plays a role. You abandoned it after the rape, going, of course, for scholarly endeavors. Where are you now in terms of your approach to faith?
Well, this is a very good question. So I was studying theology at the time that I was raped. I was getting a PhD in religious studies at Emory University. And I think that theological discourse, discourse about God, questions of a kind of worldview that was going to be sort of holding for me, broke. And I think my faith in the state broke as well, because they didn't really offer me what felt like justice, certainly not justice from on high. But over the course of writing this book, what was perhaps most surprising to me was that I found myself thinking about religion and thinking about faith in a very different way. And it really came through the objects. So I write about some of these objects as relics, and thinking through the idea of a relic as a kind of living memory. The ways in which they are cared for and held, and the kinds of beautiful containers that only extend their holiness, was something that was not something I would have ever imagined when I was studying theology in 1989 as a way of my being in the world. So I find myself down here in the muck, down here in a kind of this-worldly faith that really focuses more about material religion, about kind of the ways in which we don't have control of these objects, right? We can use them as evidence, but they're not contained by those narratives. And the ways in which we can't contain them is part of what makes them holy in my experience. And there's a kind of humility that comes with that kind of acknowledgement that I find meaningful and powerful. And I also want to say that the other way in which this really came to be in the writing of this book was just a sense over and over again, as I was working on this book for over 10 years, that I was kind of on the right path, that there would be these little signs, and you know, from the universe that kind of said, oh yeah, this quirky thing you're doing makes sense. And that kind of serendipity, you know, having read Maggie Nelson's The Red Parts, only to, you know, I finished the book. I was at a conference, and I got back to my hotel room, and I turned on the television, and there was Maggie Nelson on 48 Hours Murder Mystery, something she writes about in the book with some ambivalence and trepidation, and there she was on the screen, and I thought, wow, the universe is telling me something. And I can't contain or control that. And I find it both wondrous and powerful.
I did want to ask you that, kind of jumping all over the place here, but there is connection among it all. After Anita Hill's testimony at Clarence Thomas's Supreme Court confirmation hearings, you say your mother discussed your rape with then-Senator Joe Biden. Could you expand on this?
Yeah, this is one of the strange things that happens when you're from a very small state. I think you're in Albany, New York, where my father grew up. And that state capital is a very vast and big place compared to Dover, Delaware. And so my parents, my mother was a school teacher, my father worked for the Social Security Administration. And in Delaware, we had access to Joe Biden. You didn't have to be wealthy. My parents spent many, many years going to these Biden seminars at his house. I think he had them monthly. And they worked on his campaigns, and they knew him. And so, you know, he started working on the legislation, the Violence Against Women Act, not long after that hearing. And because he was working on that, I had a conversation with my mother saying that she asked permission to talk to him about my rape, and I said yes. And I also told her that if he had wanted me to testify in Washington, that I would have done that. I was not called upon to testify, but she did talk to him about it. And it is a little humbling now that he is president of the United States.
What would you like to see him do in the area of women's rights and victims of violence and things of that nature?
Well, there are many things. First of all, I want to really make sure that that health care is available, including reproductive care, is available to all who need it, and not only women, but also for trans and otherwise queer folks to have access to the kinds of care that they need. That's a very, very big thing. And, of course, for those who need to have abortion services, that they have them available. But more than that, I guess I want to go back to the question of violence. And I would really, really hope that more attention could be paid to all of those unprocessed rape kits. The idea that an actress who plays the part of an officer in a special victims unit is the national spokesperson for trying to get rape kits processed in the United States seems like, you know, an obscene reality. This should be a national priority, and all of those rape kits should be processed so that we can figure out if there are serial rapists and begin to use the technology that's available. That's really one of my bigger hopes.
Thank you for sharing that. Is there something that you really wanted to talk about or mention? Please feel free.
It's just really important to me to remember that you don't have to be alone. Because it's that loneliness that really gets to you. And I think I write about this in the book. I talk about Svetlana Baum, a literary scholar, who talked about something called diasporic intimacy. And she says diasporic intimacy happens when you've lost everything, and then you can be surprised by moments of tenderness. And I've certainly experienced those moments, and my hope is that others who are lonely, as I was, might experience them as well.
Laura Levitt's book is The Objects That Remain. That's our show for this week. Thanks to Tina Rennick for production assistance. Our executive producer is Dr. Alan Shartok. Our theme music is Glow in the Dark by Kevin Bartlett. This show is a national production of Northeast Public Radio. If you'd like to hear this show again, sign up for our podcast or visit the 51% archives on our website at wamc.org. This week's show is number 1645.